tell your story. Started out simple, and just as fast as you can. Oh, we're gonna give love a full love in a man. And if you don't treat it right,
hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with four members of the local band Nickel Revolution. Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is August 28th, 2012, and I'm talking with Kent Saunders, Scott Jeffy, Jerry Lenz, and Louis Lenz from the Nickel Revolution. Guys, if you wouldn't mind, let's start with your full name, date of birth, and your hometown, please.
Kent Saunders, January 14th, 1950. Minneapolis is my hometown.
Scott Jeffy. September 3rd, 1949, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Jerry Lenz, March 9th, 1950, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Louis Lenz, August 7th, 1948, also born in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And how did you guys first become interested in music?
Louis and I, in our family, grew up around music. Our dad was self-taught on the guitar and organ and harmonica. And was, I mean, he would sing for mom, sing for us. We'd kind of laugh when we were kids. He'd play the guitar and had one of those harmonica holders. And they were great at dancing, loved music, forced us to take organ lessons. So it was a musical household. So that's how we, as brothers, got involved in it. And then, of course, meeting the others in the band kind of one by one.
Well, what happened was I knew that Gerald in junior high started playing drums. Keith Falsey, you could hear him two blocks away pounding on the piano or the organ, decided he needed to start a band.
What part of town did you guys grow up in?
Golden Valley.
And when did you get your first band together?
It was the fall of 1964. Louis had a couple of different friends that were interested in a band, and so people would come over to the house. I had convinced my parents to loan me the money to buy drums, and that kind of helped move things along. I think, Louis, if I'm correct, you were the one that talked to Keith Falsey.
Yep.
That's how we started with Keith in the band. And then there's kind of an interesting story about how Scott then came along. Why don't you take
From what I remember, Keith was going out with Scott's sister, so I believe Keith told me, well, why don't you ask Scott? So we're in the home room together, and I sent him a note in home room. Do you want to be in my band? That's how it started.
But there's another interesting story. One of the reasons we were really interested in Scott, we didn't know about his playing ability, but it was a trip that his family had taken that year. Tell him where he had gone.
Well, my mother was from Great Britain. She wanted to take us all over there, and we'd never been there. I was 14 at the time. Really wasn't too sure what the Beatles were all about, but I learned a whole lot more when I was over there. Came back with a pair of Beatle boots, and I thought, well, I need to be in the music business.
Yeah, you didn't need to play a musical instrument. You'd been to England, you knew about the Beatles, you're in the band. Boom.
Exactly.
Okay, and did your new band have a name?
At the beginning, it was the Wailing Phantoms for a short period of time doing garage playing in people's houses.
What was the name of your new band?
Wailing Phantoms.
Did the band play anywhere?
One gig at the VFW that my father belonged to in South Minneapolis.
And it was for children we've got pictures of us playing, and these kids were probably no more than 6 or 7 years old. We got a picture of one with his fingers in his ears. We knew three songs. We thought we were the Beatles.
Of course, it was a Christmas party for the kids. That's what it was.
And yeah. It was, we just thought we were the biggest rock stars that had ever hit the earth.
So tell me a couple of the songs that the Wailing Phantoms would have played live.
The first song we learned was The Grind by Gregory D and the Avantes. And I think we played that three times that day. We played Jingle Bells, and I do not remember what other song was, but Jingle Bells was the token. We got to play a Christmas song for the kids. One note of interest, that show, Axel was there, and he was a big attraction. So we got to open for Axel.
He was the TV personality.
Clellan Card.
Right.
Oh, Channel 4 was
four? It? 4, yeah, it was Channel 4.
Any other songs the Wailing Phantoms did?
We must have done Louie Louie.
Well, it was things like Doo-Wah Diddy. Yeah, it was early.
But I'm trying to remember. I don't think we had a PA system. So
no,
we didn't.
We played through the amp.
And interestingly enough, I wasn't a bass player at the time. And so we both, Louie and I, had the same Kingston guitars.
Yeah, from music
and plan. You had one, what was your amp?
A Silvertone amp.
We both plugged into it. We played the exact same chords. And I'm sure it sounded pathetic, but like I said, we thought we were cool.
Jerry, what was your first drum set?
My first drum set came from Schmidt Music. It consisted, it was an Apollo drum set. It was used, I remember this very well because I worked hard for it. It was $100, came from Schmidt Music, was blue sparkle, had a bass drum, a mounted tom, a mounted cymbal, and a snare drum. That was the complete set.
Okay, what happens to the Wailing Phantoms?
Well, we immediately worked on coming up with a cool name, and the whole idea for the Enchanters was obviously misspelling it like the Beatles misspelled Beatles, so it was N-I-N, Chanters was the idea, to have something really cool.
Oh, all the good names had already been taken, so that's why we ended up with the Enchanters.
Where did the Enchanters play?
A lot of free things, and we ended up playing at Robbinsdale.
Yeah.
Robbinsdale had a teen night, sock hops, on a Friday night was for the junior high school students, and Saturday nights were for the seniors. You got $30 a night if you played for the junior high people, and $60 a night for the to go upstairs and play for the seniors. And do you remember having to carry Keith's family's organ up the stairs?
Yeah,
two flights of stairs.
Louie, where was that teen center located?
Right in downtown Robbinsdale,
above the police station.
Right.
Yes, above the police station.
And any other places the Enchanters played?
Well, actually, we were booking ourselves. And we had some gigs like Clarissa Ballroom. Again, it was wherever family had some connections and stuff like that. Our family had some connections up there, so we played there. We had a couple other ballroom-type gigs on a small scale.
At the New Hope Pool, we would play up there for free. What was the name
of
the place?
We played parties,
What was the name of the place? So that we got paid $3.
I don't know. It's on the calendar. It was Alexandria. We're trying to figure out if that was payment or a tip for $3. But Scott was kind of our accountant, keeping track of how much we made.
Okay, so then that brings us up to the summer of 65, and you did get a job at Breezy Point. Tell me about that event.
Well, again, that's before we were in the union, and so it was another family relation. Our uncle was part owner in this incredible resort, Breezy Point. And Breezy Point had just developed a new teen center. So he called my dad, said, "Do you think the boys would want to come up here and play?" And it was like, "Oh, yeah." So we played there more than once, but it was an incredible gig because they put us up, they fed us, we got to water ski and play all day long, and then play at the teen club at night. And it was usually two bands, and it was just a blast, an absolute blast. We really, again, felt like we were the Beatles at that point.
But it solidified our idea that we were on the right track, and we were doing exactly what we wanted to be doing.
And by that point, we had already bought new equipment. I had Slingerland drums. We had picked up some Fender equipment.
We were
taking whatever we made and reinvesting it in equipment immediately.
What happens to the Enchanters next?
So at this point, Keith Follissey was a huge part of the band, and in many cases, some of our bookings came through him and his family and relationships and things like that. And he was pushing for us to work with Dick Shapiro at Central Booking Agency, and Dick would listen to us, talk to us. At that point in time, they had tryouts for bands, and we would go to those tryouts. So it was right about this time where they told us, you guys are ready. What we need you to do is join the union. So we all applied for the union, went down and played for the union guys, which that was interesting. And, it's about half a song. It's like, okay, you're in, it's like, we'll cash the check. You're in the union now. But it's funny because, again, Scott was the one keeping track of the money. And overnight, you know, we went from $60 gigs to $125 and $150, and Dick got us jobs. I mean, constantly. It was really fast and swift. So it was a good move. That would bring us up to that fall.
So what happens to the band at that point?
Well, at that point, Keith was at a point where he wanted to go off on his own, start his own group. He had discussed it with us over time and everything, and he began a group called The Knicks. And The Knicks, and Scott, you can add to it, talking about what the material was that Keith wanted to do.
Well, he wanted to play a lot of Beatles songs, and he was, at that point, had gotten interested in writing his own music. I mean, we were okay with that, but it wasn't something that we were really interested in doing. And he really wanted to go off and he'd partner, or he'd gotten real friendly with some kids from Robbinsdale High School at the time. And Gary Lopak in particular had a real high falsetto voice, and he could sing Paul McCartney tunes and notes and hit all the high notes. And Keith thought, hey, this is what I want to do.
Keith was very involved in music classes at Robbinsdale, and that's where he met the friends that would form the Knicks, and they were only the Knicks for a short period of time, and I believe it was Marsh had renamed them the Youngsters. So at that point, we needed a keyboard player immediately. I believe what we did was ran ads in Connie's Insider, and that's when Honey Bear got a hold of us. Honey Bear came, we liked him. He liked the band, but he also said that at that point we needed somebody stronger on guitar to play lead. So Louie went to rhythm, and we added Jeff Simon as well.
And Honey Bear was a nickname for
Ron Hort.
Okay, so the new lineup now is who playing what?
Louie Lenz on rhythm, Scott Jeffy on bass, Jerry Lenz on drums, Ron Hort on keyboards and vocals, and Jeff Simon on lead guitar.
What happens next with the band?
Well, at that point, we were carrying on with a lot of the tunes that we had learned, but we also brought on some pretty serious talent. Honey Bear was turned out to be a very, very good keyboard player. He had a really good voice. Jeff Simon was a pretty good guitar player, and it opened up some new vistas for us, and we were able to branch out and start learning some more songs, which got us into some longer sets, some better sets, and musically, we really started to branch out.
One of the things that was big, one of the big things that happened at that point was Dick Shapiro booked us in Missouri, and at that point, that was the furthest away that we had played. We'd played the five-state area, ballrooms, typical school dances, things like that. But Dick Shapiro got us booked in Missouri, and we played at a college there. And the comedian, he was more of a comedian at that point, but Dick Gregory was the headliner, and he was a civil rights activist. And it was very exciting to have that, to be able to meet him. He was funny. He was interesting. The civil rights movement was huge at that point. The college had booked a big dance band, and then they booked us, a rock band, so that more of the students would come and see Dick Gregory. In addition to playing, it was just fun. We have some pictures from it, and had a lot of fun, and of course a long trip home.
But there was one other point that I wanted to bring up. I have a vivid memory of five guys packed into a van, starving, and we pulled up to an all-you-can-eat buffet. After about an hour, they asked us to leave.
Yeah, Honey Bear was a big part of the band, a very big part of it.
And Honey Bear was considerably larger than he is today. And probably in his life.
Okay, at some point, the band has a name change from The Enchanters to Nickel Revolution. What's the story behind the name change?
Well, we'd been asked by our booking agent to think about a new name, something a little more progressive. We were at a loss. We were just searching for some kind of name that would give us some kind of recognition and something that might be a little more timely. And we happened to be at my house, and we were sitting around the kitchen table one day, and we were just looking for anything. And I happened to notice an article in the paper about a nickel revolution, and it had to do with the fact that they were changing over the composition of how they made the nickel. And the idea was that because they were changing it from a valuable metal to something a little bit less expensive to make, there was a real shortage of these things. So
they were made of silver up to that point.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, so they were switching to a cheaper metal. And what did this result in then?
Well, a shortage of nickels around the country, and this big revolution about how there were people were starting to hoard these nickels. So, and it was, we put it down on a list of possible names, and eventually it stuck.
And I think, too, it fit. If you think about the timing and what bands were called, like the Underbeats, the Accents, the Enchanters fits in that
era.
Whole vein. But the music had taken a big shift, and when you look at the Nickel Revolution and you look at big acts, things like Canned Heat, Vanilla Fudge, you know, and it's like that's when they began, you know, let's put two words together, you know, and of course that's where Nickelback got their name. They went no.
Yeah, you tried to fool me with that one.
And I understand a local musician came up with the logo for your band that you used on your bass drum head, Jerry.
Right. Well, the Candy Floss, which was at that time, we were contracted with Candy Floss for promotional type things and recording, but they were packaging bands. In other words, what do you look like? What do you sound like? And they wanted to create images for the bands. They did a lot of contract work with Skip Dolan, who played in the Accents, who was a very talented artist. And he came up with the concept of the Indian head based on an Indian head nickel. Came up with an awesome design that fit the times, but today still is just, it's just cool.
It's timeless.
The color composition is fantastic.
Yeah.
Did
yeah.
he actually paint?
He painted it on my drum head.
And we went so far as to have a nickel on the front of the van, painted on the van. We had our name and on the side of the van, and it was just a whole package.
Yeah, it was branding at that point, and that was real early for bands to be doing that type of things. But that's where the logo and how the logo was used for posters and all sorts of things.
What places around town did the Nickel Revolution play?
Well, Magoo's was one of the places. The barn, the prison, someplace else up in Robbinsdale. Danceland, as well as any other.
Armory?
Yeah.
Minneapolis
the Armory.
Ooh, trying to think of all the names of the places back
then. Well, we got to do some
New City Opera House.
Yeah.
Hullabaloo, wasn't that one of them?
Yeah.
Yep.
The convention center, when we got to be a front band for the shows that came in, like Wilson Pickett, Strawberry Alarm Clock.
Right.
You guys remember that club in St. Paul? It might have been called the Cabaret.
Yep.
Yes.
We did. Yep, Cabaret. Was
and I think that was the first time that I met Dick Headland when he was playing with the Mystics, and we were playing opposite those guys.
In the Casino Royale?
We had our seersucker coats.
And what time period does Kent come in?
Jeff Simon was with the band for a very short period of time. If I'm correct, it was early in '67 that you joined late in 67?
It was July.
July.
July-ish.
Well, that's right in the middle now.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Because it was right after high school for me.
Kent, have you played in a band prior to Nickel Revolution?
Yeah, I played in a high school band, Southwest area. We called ourselves the Four Fifths.
The Four Fifths.
Right.
And what did you play, Kent?
I played lead guitar by default.
Okay.
Somebody had to do it.
So you come in July 67, and what happens next to in the history of the band?
Well, one of the things that happened with Kent coming on board is he brought a different era of music to us. We at that point had been playing certainly a lot of covers, and that's what we did during that whole time period, but we were playing a lot of just pop stuff off the radio, and Kent brought an R&B background that we were not familiar with. And
he brought a voice too.
Yes, he did.
Kent, where did you get your R&B background from?
Just kind of where I settled. I grew up listening to Lawrence Welk got me kind of interested in playing. And so as all these styles evolved, I was really attracted to the Beach Boys. I'd go take my weekly guitar lesson and come home and copy Beach Boys and Chuck Berry just because that's what I heard. And pretty much started out as a rhythm player because the rhythms were what attracted me to the whole thing.
So there was a change in the sound of the band at this time.
Yes.
There was a huge change in the sound of the band. And shortly after Kent joined it, and he's helping then mold the sound. One of the things, too, is Kent is probably the most talented out of all the people that have ever been in the band. And
yeah, he didn't just bring the voice, he brought the guitar.
Well, all those things, but I can remember specifically, and these are the things that sometimes bands have arguments and whatnot, but when you listen to one another, I can remember very specifically Kent telling me that my drumming had to come up a lot, and he was playing, he had been playing with an excellent drummer, so he knew immediately that I needed to increase my ability. I listened to what he had to say, and I immediately went to B-sharp music, and I got lessons with Rod Eaton, who also happened to go to Robbinsdale, so I knew who he was. And, of course, he played with TC Atlantic and other groups. But Rod was my drum teacher, and so every week I would go there, and I learned a lot from Rod. It really helped me improve. But Kent was that kind of encouragement for everybody, for Scott and Louie. Ron pretty much held his own, and Ron and Kent complimented one another. But then to expand the sound and this R&B sound, we added the sax player, John Berman. Now, I don't remember how Berman got in the group. Did you bring him?
Nope.
It was Bear.
Honey Bear brought him in.
Honey Bear brought him.
It was his idea.
And John Berman had a nickname, apparently.
The Fly.
The Fly. Any idea how he was nicknamed The Fly?
I think it had something to do with the way he danced. Or was he was a fly?
Well, we could all have our own idea of what that meant.
Yeah.
Kent, it's always interesting sometimes to find out about some of the equipment people played on. What kind of guitar did you play when you joined Nickel Revolution?
I either had a Guild Starfire.
That's the one I remember.
Because we ended
up
with
Guild.
I might
have had an SG, but I don't think so.
I ended up with a Guild, and Scott ended up with a Guild bass.
That's exactly what happened. You played a Guild, and again, he had such an influence that these two guys got rid of, well, you didn't get rid of your Fender. You kept Fender.
Actually, at that point, I interesting side story. I bought, when I realized we didn't need two guitar players playing the exact same chords, they said, well, one of us has to go learn them how to play the bass. Went down and saw the Coronados, who became the Hot Half Dozen, and I fell in love with the bass player's Candy Apple Red Precision 1963 Fender bass. And I don't remember what I had to do to get this thing, but I ended up with it. And it was as big as I was and weighed as much as I did. But I had that thing, and I loved that bass. But Kent came along, and the next thing I knew, I don't know what, to this day, I don't remember what happened to that bass. I wish I still had. I probably traded it, sold it, traded it in, and ended up with a red Guild Starfire bass with the black flat wound strings on it.
And I had the red color. I mean, we matched.
Did I have a Sunburst Starfire, or did I have the...
I believe,
a Starfire 4. I remember that.
We got pictures of it.
The Sunburst one is Starfire 4.
It definitely influenced us. There was no question.
Right. At one point, I had a cherry red one for a minute and a half.